Like to mention at the beginning of this year that for festive reasons there will be no shiur next week due to Hanukkah. Torah study, of course, as always, is warmly encouraged, but will not be taking place within the framework of this shiur next week. So, Mir Hashem, we will pick up in 2 weeks' time Parshas Vayigash. This week is Parshas Vayeshev, and that will also be put aside for the sake of Hanukkah discussions. There is no lack of what to discourse on Parshas Vayeshev, the Dover Be'ito of Hanukkah will occupy our attention this evening. And of course, there's a great deal to say there. I wanted to speak, before we get on to more perhaps thematic material with regards to Hanukkah, about an aspect of the mitzvah of menorah, which relates to everyone, and there has been much said about it and much to say about it, namely the timing of the mitzvah. From when, until when, and what if? Now, as far as the Gemara is concerned, things couldn't be simpler. The Gemara deals with this within two lines. In Masechah Shabbos, of course, within Bame Madlikin, that's where the Gemara speaks about the halachas of Hanukkah, comparing lighting of Hanukkah with lighting of Shabbos. And there, in Daf Kaf Aleph Amud Beis, the Gemara says, quotes a brisa, mitzvas haner mishetishka chama, from the time the sun sets, ad shetichla regel minashuk, until the last people leave the marketplace. Those are two terms that we will need to define. What is the meaning of Mishetishka Chama, from when the sun has set? And what is the definition of Tichle Regel Minashuk? And how does it relate to us? Now, in terms of the early time, from when, we should preface, we see these two words in front of us, Mishetishka Chama, from when the sun has set. As we know, without getting into too many details, for they are many, but there are two primary times that we need to keep in mind. We call them Shkia, sunset, and Seisa Kochavim, when the stars come out. Shkia, sunset, is when the body of the sun is no longer visible. That means it has sunk beneath the horizon. That is called Shkia. As we know, of course, there continues to be a good amount of light for a while yet from the sun, even though the body of the sun is itself cannot be concealed from view. But nonetheless, it still gives forth light until it goes down further and further, and that's what we call night, Seisa Kochavim. Here in Eretz Yisrael, without getting into Rabbeinu Tam, if we take the normative minhag, which is of the Gaonim, there is rated approximately 15 to 20 minutes between Shkia and Seis HaKochavim. And that being said, the question that we need to ask is, when the Talmud says that the time from which we light, the time to light, is Mishetishka Chama, where does that feature on the scale of sunset versus stars out, Shkia versus Seis HaKochavim? And this is a matter that is addressed explicitly by the Rosh, interestingly, not within the context of the Gemara and Shabbos there, but actually in his halachic comments on Maseches Tanis. And the reason why is because the Gemara says there in Tanis that when a person is fasting, and that's what Maseches Tanis is about, the fast is not over ad shetishka chama, until the sun has set. Now, as we know, a fast day is not over at the time that we call Shkia. A fast day is not over until night, until Tzitzah Kochavim. And that is absolutely the case. And says the Rosh, we see from here that the Talmud uses the expression Mishatishka Chama sometimes not to refer purely to the time of sunset, but till all the light of the sun has disappeared, i.e. Tzeisak HaChovim, that's when a fast is over, and that, says the Rosh, is what the Gemara means in Shabbos when it says the time to light the menorah is Mishetishka Chama. It means from the time that all of the light from the sun has disappeared, Tzeisak HaChovim, that is the starting point. This position of the Rosh, not surprisingly, is held by the Tur, who was his son, Rabbi Yaakov ben Asher, and it is adopted by the Shulchan Aruch. So in Siman Tafresh Ayin Beis, the Shulchan Aruch says that the time is from the end of Shkia, and the end of Shkia within this context means the very end, Tzeisak HaChovim. Now, the Shulchan Aruch does not give entry to any other opinion. However, there is another opinion. And it comes out in a most interesting way, because they don't really advertise it, but it is clearly held by a number of Rishonim, foremost amongst them, the Rashba and the Ran, two of the great Rishonim, quoted by the Vilna Gaon. And the way that it emerges from their discussion is they get to asking, when the Gemara says that the time to begin lighting is from Mishatishka Chama, whenever that is it possible to light before? And in a sense, the background to the question is, there is at least one day of Hanukkah, at least, that you have to light before, namely Friday. Because, says the Rashba and the Ran, almost identical phraseology, there is no way that you can light at the normal time, obviously, on Friday, because if you do, it is already Bein HaShmoshos, it is already the twilight zone, it is already that in-between time. So now the question is, given that there's one day of Hanukkah that we know that you can light before, does that exist as an option, maybe even in the other days, if a person so desires, or for whatever other reason? Now, without even answering yet that question as to whether you could answer earlier, from between the words of the Rashba and the Ran, we see very clearly that they have a different definition of when the starting time for Hanukkah lights is. For again, their argument is, on Erev Shabbos, there is no way that you can light at the normal time, because if you do, you are already in Bein HaShmoshos. Now, Bein HaShmoshos is the time, those 15/20 minutes, between sunset and Tzeisak HaChovim. They have actually just now defined the regular time for lighting as the beginning of Bein HaShmoshos, which is what we call Shkia, sunset. And this is pointed out by the Vilna Gaon. He quotes the Rashba, he quotes the Ran, and the Vilna Gaon is not given to many words, certainly not in print, and he concludes with the words, V'chein Iker, and that's it. Meaning, V'chein Iker, the words of the Rashba and the Ran are definitive. With these two words, the Vilna Gaon changed the lives of more or less everyone who lives in Israel. And the reason is that the minag, certainly in Yerushalayim and also beyond, is like the Vilna Gaon, because of the Vilna Gaon. As we've mentioned many times, the early Ashkenazi yeshuv in the early 1800s were Talmidim of the Vilna Gaon. Therefore, without even knowing it, a lot of the fabric of minag Ashkenaz here in Eretz Yisrael is actually influenced by the Gaon, who really encourages Talmidim to come to Eretz Yisrael, and they set up a lot of the communities here. And this is a classic example. Whereas the Shulchan Aruch, if you only ever learned the Shulchan Aruch, which would not be a bad thing at all, but if you only ever learned the Shulchan Aruch, so you would only see Tzeisak HaChovim, and indeed in Chutz La'aretz that is the default, but in Eretz Yisrael, the Vilna Gaon has set the tone, and many light at Shkia because of that. We should mention that there are only two possibilities, either sunset or Tzeisak HaChovim. That said, there are more than two opinions. In Chutz La'aretz, there are a number of different minhagim for various Chutz La'aretz reasons. That is to say, there sometimes is a much longer span of time between Shkia and Tzeisak HaChovim, And therefore, Moshe Feinstein says in the Igros Moshe, one should light 10 minutes after Shkia. Rav Aaron Kotler said one should light 20 minutes after Shkia. And these are, everyone has their own minog, and everyone follows their own poskim there. But here in Eretz Yisrael, the two normative minhagim are either Tzeisa Kochavim, like the Shulchan Aruch, or Shkia, like the Vilna Gaon. And this actually led to a very interesting question that was asked of Shlomo Zalman Orbach. Namely, if a child becomes bar mitzvah on one of the nights of Hanukkah, which could happen, and as we know, the certain mitzvahs that you could possibly do them before Tzeisa Kochavim, but of course Tzeisa Kochavim is when he becomes bar mitzvah. So he has two choices. He can, and if his family has the minhag of lighting at Shkia, so he can either light at Shkia, in which case that will be probably the last mitzvah he does as a 12-year-old, or he can wait 20 minutes. And at least for this light of Hanukkah, light as a gadol, as an adult. What should he do? And Rav Shlomo Zalman said, as true as it is that one would have thought perhaps to delay the mitzvah in order that he should fulfill it as a gadol, but if his family minhag is Shkia, he should light his Shkia, and that will be the last day that he lights as pre-bar mitzvah, and from tomorrow he'll light his Shkia as a bar mitzvah boy. So that's a very interesting shaila, and many people speak about it. It is true that the Shulchan Aruch quotes one of the Rishonim, who states that in extenuating circumstances, a person can light beforehand, similar to Shabbos candles, really, from Plag HaMincha, even during the other days, but that really needs to be something of an emergency. Otherwise, we have the two times, each one according to their minhag. So that is with regards to Mishetishka Chama, and that is the origins, actually, of the two primary minhagim. What about until when? Until when can one light? Ad shetich leregel min hashuk, until the last people leave the shuk. When is that? Well, the Rif actually gives a time frame of half an hour. Half an hour after nightfall, that's when everyone will be home already, and therefore one lights within that time. Not only does one light within that time, but when we try and light at the beginning, one has either candles long enough or oil enough to burn until that time, which is also important. And now we come to the two critical questions on this concept of tichle regel min hashuk. The first one, which has to be asked, is what happens if a person missed that as well? Couldn't get home, and if Tzeis HaKochavim, this time of year, will be 5 o'clock, and it's 5:30 already, and didn't make it, then what? And it only has to happen to one person for it to be a shaila. And here we have a major dispute among the Rishonim. The Rambam in Hilchos Chanukah, Perek Dalet Halacha He, states very clearly, Ein madlikin neros Chanukah kodem sheteshka chama, one doesn't light before Shkia, Elo im Shkiyosa, with the sunset, which really actually sounds a lot like the position of the Vilna Gaon, lo ma'achrin v'lo makdimin. In terms of the lighting, you don't delay, you don't bring it earlier. If a person forgot, says the Rambam, so then madlik v'holeich, or if for any reason, if he didn't light at that correct time, madlik v'holeich, ad shetich l'regel min hashuk, until people have left the shuk, v'kama hu zman zeh, kumo chatzi sha'ah o yeter. Half an hour, maybe more. Avarz manze, eino madlik. If a person missed this time, this half an hour, that's it. He missed the time. Now, the words of the Rambam are very clear. The timing of an achetech l'ergum and ashuk is critical and non-negotiable. It's not lechatchila, it's absolute. That said, the tour argues with the Rambam, and not only does he argue with the Rambam, he says he argues with the Rambam. The Tur in Tafresh Ayin Beis says that, of course, a person should try and light, do whatever he can to light in the correct time, which is from Mishiteshka until If that time passed for whatever reason, he still lights, says the Torah. Udelo keharambam, not like what the Rambam said. So, doesn't speak about it. Which means yes. Because if the answer was no, he would have spoken about it. Now, it's interesting to ponder what is behind this machlokas. The Rambam says it's got to be the half an hour, and the Torah says it should be the half an hour, but beyond that, you can still light. So the Mefarshim explain that this brings us to consider a very important concept that is in the forefront of mitzvahs like Chanukah, which is called Persumei Nisa. There is no question that the timing of Ner Chanukah, so that there are passers-by to see it, is lefarsim es hanes, in order to publicize. So Persumei Nisa is without a doubt a very important part of the mitzvah of Ner Chanukah, as it is with a couple of other mitzvahs. The question is this. Is it exactly that, an important part of the mitzvah? Or perhaps is it more than that? Is it not only a part of the mitzvah? Could it be that it is the essence of the mitzvah? The definition of Ner Chanukah could be lefarsim es hanes. If you don't have Persumei Nisa, you don't have anything, because that is the mitzvah. This is the question. Could it be that it's an aspect of the mitzvah? And of course one should ideally try and have it, but if you don't, there exists a body of the mitzvah without that aspect. Or could it be, no, this is the be-all and end-all of the mitzvah? And if we consider the words of the Rambam himself, we may get a very clear answer to this question. The Rambam, as he introduces the background to Chanukah in Perek Gimel of Hilchos Chanukah, he tells the whole story of the Chashmor Noyim, which is interesting. It's more or less the only story that he tells for a very simple reason. The Rambam wrote in his, he doesn't tell, for example, the background to the Purim story or any of the other stories or any of the other Chagim. But the answer, say the Mefarshim, is because the Rambam has told us in his introduction to the Mishneh Torah that if you're looking for a basic Jewish education, read the Tanakh and read this my Sefer, the Mishneh Torah. And if you do, you pretty much know what you need to know. So if you read the Tanakh, you'll know the background to Pesach and the background to Purim and the background to Sukkot and the background to Shavuos. But you can read the Tanakh 1,000 times, you will never find out the background to the story of Chanukah, because it happened after the sealing of the Tanakh. And therefore, the Rambam, true to his commitment, said, you need Tanakh and my Sefer. If it's not in Tanakh, I'm going to have to tell you the story of Chanukah, which he does. So the first two halachas are describing the story, and of course, when the Rambam tells it, every word is of the essence. And then says the Rambam, because of everything, because of the war and because of the oil and the whole thing, as we know. So the Chachamim of that generation instituted, these 8 days, each and every night we light candles at the entrance to the house, laharos ulegalos hanes, to display and to reveal the miracle. Now, what's very interesting about these words of the Rambam is that they are introductory words. The Rambam yet has two entire chapters with which to give us all the details we could want to know about in terms of Ner Chanukah. When, what, how, whom, everything. So the introduction is just that. It is only to give us the mitzvah in one sentence and details to follow. And if that's true, so when the Rambam says, "Umadlikin bahem neiros be'erev al pisrei habatim," that we light outside, that seems to be, where exactly? By the door of the house. That's a detail of the mitzvah. As surely as how many candles, and what time, and where exactly, I mean, those are details. Why does the Rambam incorporate this in his very presentation at the outset of the mitzvah of Chanukah? The answer is because it is an in part and parcel, it is the mitzvah. The definition of Ner Chanukah is not to light the menorah for the Rambam. The definition of the mitzvah is to light the menorah outside the house. That's yet part of the dictionary definition. And certainly, as the Rambam goes on to say, Laharos ulegalos hanes. That's all part of the mission of the mitzvah, the original definition, to show and to reveal the miracle. If that's true, it seems very clear that for the Rambam, Pirsumei Nisa is inextricably bound up with the mitzvah itself. Without Pirsumei Nisa, there is no mitzvah. And if the window for Pirsumei Nisa is that half an hour, then if you've missed it, you don't have anything. That's why the Rambam says, Ovar zman ze eino madlik. The Torah, on the other hand, takes the approach that is as important as it is that there be a concept, an aspect of Pirsumei Nisa together with the mitzvah, but there exists a mitzvah beyond Pirsumei Nisa. And if you missed it, that's a shame, but you still have the mitzvah in front of you for the entire night. And what's fascinating is, not only are they disputing this very fundamental question as to the relationship between the mitzvah of lighting and Pirsumei Nisa, are they one and the same, or are they two separate things? But ultimately, they will be discussing what family does the mitzvah of Chanukah lights belong to? Mitzvahs have families. For example, there are certain mitzvahs that are mitzvahs of day. They apply the whole day. Saying Hallel, taking Lulav. I mean, these are mitzvahs only a day, but all day in principle. There are mitzvahs of the night. Eating matzah, reading the Megillah. Those are mitzvahs. They have to be done at night, but you have, in principle, all night. And now, we come to Ner Chanukah. Does Ner Chanukah belong to either of these families? Or does it stand alone? As if to say, do we say that at heart, it's a nighttime mitzvah? It's like, in principle, reading the Megillah at night, or eating matzah at night. So you light the menorah at night. It is true that there is a greater insistence, much greater, to light in the first half an hour for the Pirsumei Nisa, but if that for some reason did not work out, the mitzvah remains, and it's a mitzvah of the night, and you have all night. So at heart, it belongs to that family. Or could it be no? The mitzvah is not a mitzvah of the night. It borrows some of the night. It uses a quality that the night has called darkness. For the other mitzvahs, it doesn't make a difference. It's not because the night is dark that you perform the mitzvah at that time. The eating of matzah on Seder night is not because it's dark outside. It's because it's night. The lighting of the menorah, you need darkness in order for the light, it's an effect, to give a background so that the light is mefars in the nes. So you're using a quality of the night, but it's not a nighttime mitzvah. You need the confluence of two factors. The fact that it's dark, so the light will be visible, and the fact that there are people there to see it. And that window of confluence is half an hour. Beyond that, the fact that it's night is neither here nor there, because there's no people there anymore. And that is the quintessential question here. For the Rambam, it's not a nighttime mitzvah. It uses darkness for that half an hour. For the Torah, at heart, is the nighttime mitzvah. The Shulchan Aruch, in this respect, actually, paskens like the Torah, not like the Rambam. That is to say, once again, and we cannot stress enough, every effort needs to be made to light in the correct time. If something happened and a person was not able to, then he has the entire night. And it sounds like the Shulchan Aruch has sided with the Torah in his understanding of the mitzvah, that at heart, it's to light. If you can be mefarsed in the neis, that's the way to do it. But if not, you still have a mitzvah, even after that time. However, it is possible that the two views are not so far apart, because there is a famous ruling of the Magen Avraham for a person who comes home late, past the half an hour, and the Shulchan Aruch says he should light with a bracha. Says the Magen Avraham, but there's got to be someone there to see the menorah, someone other than him, family or friends or whatever. Ad kedei kach, that if it's very late, it is, the Magen Avraham says, if the, some, everyone in the family is sleeping, wake someone up. Someone has to see it. Now, if that's true, then it turns out that the dispute between the Shulchan Aruch and the Rambam is not so much about whether Pirsum Minispa is critical to the mitzvah. It's not about the nature of Pirsum Minispa, it's about the definition of Pirsum Minispa. Who qualifies as an audience for publicizing? All things being equal, to whom does one publicize? To the public. One's family is not the public. And therefore the Rambam says, there may be people milling around your house until all hours, but the public is gone, so there's no Pirsum Minispa. For the Shulchan Aruch, no. Even the private sector here is an acceptable audience for Pirsum Minispa, even one other person. And therefore, according to the Magen Avraham, there will always have to be someone else. So even the Shulchan Aruch requires some aspect of Pirsum Minispa, even if it's only one other person. But that said, it should be noted that there are a number of poskim, Rav Moshe Feinstein amongst them, who says that you do not have to wake anyone up, and even if it's only you, and there's no Pirsum Minispa, it is still entirely acceptable. One lights with a bracha, which then reverts back to an understanding that Pirsum Minispa ultimately is not a critical part of the mitzvah, bidyeved at least. And this brings us to the final question with regards to this matter, namely, modern times. The Gemara said, "Ad shetich l'regel min hashuk," until the last person leaves the marketplace. Now, many people are, number one, do not live near a marketplace. They may never have seen one, unless it's the stock market. Moreover, in the times of the Gemara, of course, no one would be out after dark. In fact, what's interesting is the only reason that why there were people out half an hour after dark is because the people selling firewood would stay there, because when people realized how dark it was and how little firewood they had, that's when they made their way to the firewood merchants. They're called Tarmudoi. They are the last people. They are the vanguard of the marketplace, right? They sell firewood. When they leave, there's no one left. And it's really for them, or more particularly for their customers. And in a sense, that's part of the irony of Tich L'Regel Min Hashuk, because in a perfect world, this halacha would be impossible, for the simple reason that you're meant to be publicizing it to others who are out and about, but no one should be out and about, because they should all be home in time to publicize the miracle for others, and there should be no one there. So if everyone, wouldn't it be nice if everyone was exactly on time, there would be no public. And then, well, one wonders. But the reality is, there will always be some people who are just tarrying a little bit, and it is for them that they create the window of the viewing public for Pirsum Minispa. Nowadays, businesses stay open much later with electricity, etc., and it's not as dangerous, or if it is dangerous, it's dangerous during the day anyway. So, does anything change? We should know, there are those who say nothing has changed, half an hour is always half an hour, there are certain poskim who say that it will always be no more, no less. However, the Bnei Yisoschar, the great Hasidish master, Reb Tzvi Elimelech Shapira of Dinov, in his Chidushim, he says that if businesses stay open later, then the time of Tich L'Regel Min Hashuk has expanded. And he says, my proof is from the Rambam. Where do you see it in the Rambam? Says the Bnei Yisoschar. Because if we look at the Rambam's words again, he said, "V'kama hu's manzeh?" How long is this time? "Kemo chatzi sha'a o yeser." It's about half an hour or more. Says the Bnei Yisoschar, well, decide. Is it half an hour or is it more? Because more is not half an hour. Rather, it seems to me that what the Rambam is saying is that it is approximately half an hour, but he adds the words, oh yes, sir, or more, because it could become more. Because if businesses begin to stay open for longer, then it will be more. And indeed, in our times, that's the case. And Rav Sternbuch, who actually independently made this inference of the Rambam. He does not quote the Bnei Yisrael. He actually tentatively, although he doesn't wish to impose it, but rather tentatively suggests that in our time, the Zman HaTikh L'Regel Min HaShuk is later. The average mitzvahs will stay open till 7 o'clock, barring corporate enslavement, but in terms of the general way that shops go, their closing time will be around about 7, and therefore he posits that perhaps one could say in our time, it would be half an hour after that. What he does add, which is very interesting, is that one could say that even after the stores close, but isn't it true that people are out and about till all hours, till 10 or till 11 or maybe even later? Rav Sternberg says, even if that's true, it doesn't matter. Because the principle of Tich L'Regel Min HaShuk means if a person didn't yet see the menorah because he was at work, he will see it once. But if he's seen it once, it doesn't have to be lighting for his viewing pleasure as long as he happens to be in the street. As soon as he's seen it once, he's seen it. And therefore, says Rav Sternberg, the defining time is half an hour past closing of store time, where people have gone. If they've gone, they've passed by, they've seen the menorah. If they come out again at night, it doesn't make a difference. They've seen it already. And therefore, one wouldn't need to worry beyond, even within this hidur, shall we say, of the expanded Tich L'Regel Min HaShuk, more than half an hour after the stores close. And how do things fall, therefore? It is recommended, number one, it's recommended as a hidur, certainly. I mean, we're never short on hidurim when it comes to Hanukkah, to have put a bit more oil. The truth of the matter is, any standard oil menorah will naturally light till around about that time anyway. There's much room for it. And very benignly, but of course without wishing to endorse anything, Rav Sternberg does say, and this may be something of a limud zchus, of a justification, if a person does not make it home exactly for the time, but rather an hour later or something like that, even though ideally, again, one should light at the time of Shkia or Tzeis HaKochavim, not only is he relying on the Shulchan Aruch, b'di'evid, but it could be that he is actually yet within Tich L'Regel Min HaShuk, according to this expanded view, which could go till about 7 o'clock or so. So these are some of the, I would say, highlights of the discussion of the time of Ner Chanukah, and of course that is of relevance each and every day. Now, I'd like to move from here to discuss a comment of the Medrash, which is well known with reference to Chanukah, and it begins by the Torah's first encryption of the Arba Golios. The concept of the four exiles, of which Yavon, Greece, is the third, is something that is alluded to many times in the Chumash. And the first time is almost as soon as the Chumash has begun. In Bereishis, Perek Aleph, Pasuk Beis, the second Pasuk of the entire Torah, already incorporates within it the Arba Golios. And the reason why, as the Maharal explains in his introduction to the Sefer Ner Mitzvah, which is his work on Chanukah, is because the Arba Golios, they're not four arbitrary nations who persecute the Jewish people. I mean, there have been more than four. It refers to four philosophies, four corruptions of a worldview that are embodied within each of those nations, which then confront the Jewish people. These corruptions of the way the world should be therefore find expression in the world as discussed originally when it was in a state of chaos, before HaKadosh Baruch Hu imposed order. And therefore you find the description of the Haaretz, Haisa Tohu, Vavohu, V'choshech HaPnei Tohom. There is yet no mention of any divine imposition of order in that chaos until you get to V'ruach Elokim, Rachepes HaPnei Amayim. But prior to that stage, as the Medrash lists them off, Tohu is the first Golus Bavel, Vavohu is the Golus Madai, which is when the story of Purim happened, V'choshech is Golus Yavon, and here the Medrash pauses. For it says, Vavohu, pardon me, V'choshech, why is it called Choshech, darkness? Yavon, Shehechshichu Einehem Shal Yisrael, because they were saying, they darkened the eyes of the Jewish people with the Gezeros, but there were many decrees, and the Medrash specifies one of them, Shehayu Omrim Lahem, Kislu lachem al keren hashor, write for yourselves on the horn of an ox, she'ein lachem chelek belokei Yisrael, that you have no portion with the God of Israel. That is the, in a sense, the quintessence of the decrees of Greece against the Jewish people, and we'll come back to that in a moment, Mirtz Hashem, and then to home, the depth of which the bottom is unknown, is Golus Edom, the fourth exile. And here we need to ponder. Tohu and vohu, I mean, these are rather specific expressions, they don't appear often. And clearly there's a unique equivalence and correspondence between these terms and the golus that they represent. And each one needs to be discussed. Why is tohu bavel? And why is vohu modai? What's interesting about the third one, choshech, is that it isn't specific. Every golus is typified and represented by darkness. I mean, that is a classic representation, the darkness of exile to the light of redemption. So choshech, to identify a golus, could just have easily identified any of the other three, because it's so general. So why do we take a particular golus and apply a general characteristic? Is there nothing particular to say about Yavan? I would imagine that there would be. And to come back to this issue of Kisvu lachem al keren ashor, to write on the horn of an ox. What does that mean? What horn and what ox? Well, the Rambam, in one of his lengthy letters, the Igeres Hashmad, speaks about this, and there are other sources that indicate similarly, that the context is required. To understand what it means to write on the horn of an ox, we need to appreciate that for the most part, the Jewish people in that time were involved in agriculture, and their most prized possession was the ox with which they plowed their field. And the horn of the ox, which is the most prominent and visible place of their most prized possession, was where they were told to write. Ein lanu chelek b'elokei Yisrael. It was, if one would say in the darkest sense of the word, piersum. It was to advertise. They were forced to publicize, to write in such a highly visible way. And that may be one of the reasons why Pirsum Menisa is such an important part of the mitzvah. It's because the Gezerah involved its own form of piersum. It's a terrible thing. And there have been other equivalents. So within the time, the horn of the ox represents highly visible, very important, and a very important object for them. Translated in today's terms, it would probably be something like a bumper sticker. Perhaps even a screensaver. That is the all-important message that one sees. And that was a terrible thing. Another possible interpretation of this came out, I wouldn't say by accident, but certainly through good fortune. Reb Leib Gurevitz Zatzal, who's known, of course, as the Rosh Yeshiva of Gateshead, there were a number of years that he, before he became Rosh Yeshiva, had yet left Europe. He was in London, and he served as the Rav of a kehillah there. And he told over that on one occasion, one of the Balabatim came over to him and said, Rabbi, I've just been to a very exciting exhibition in the British Museum. Would you like to hear about it? Presumably he wasn't interested in the honest answer to that question. But, and of course, Reb Leib gave the rabbi's answer, which is, of course. So the Balabas said, well, the exhibition was about baby bottles throughout the ages. That was the title. What's the point here? Well, as we know, a baby needs a very specific way in order to eat. You can't. And the food needs to be fed slowly, and so it is. How is it done? And it went through each civilization and each nation, and how exactly they went about this. The Persians, it said, for example, they used seashells, and they would pierce them a hole just enough that the the milk or whatever it was, or the water would drip through. And then the Greeks, it said, used horns of cattle. Because, once again, you can pour liquid in and you can pierce to just to get the hole just right. And that's how they would feed their children. And Reb Leib said, that is fascinating. And, of course, the Balabas had no idea why. But Reb Leib said, you framed for the Medrash. I think this may well give us a further insight into what the Medrash means. When they said, Kis v'lachem al Keren Ashor, what is the meaning of Keren Ashor? The Keren Ashor is the baby's bottle. That is to say, from day one, this is a message that needs to be fed to the children from the very beginning. So he was very much appreciative on that occasion to have gleaned that piece of information. Another approach entirely is to be found in the writings of the Shalom HaKadosh. And it begins by referring to a statement. It's in a few places in the Shas. It's in Maseches Avodah Zarah, Daf Ches, and Chulin, Daf Samach, which talks about a korban that Adam HaRishon offered after his sin. And the Gemara says it was an ox. Shor shehikriv Adam HaRishon. It was very unusual. Keren achas hayelo b'mitzcho. It had one horn in the middle of its forehead. What we would call a unicorn. And, of course, it's very specific. So specific, in fact, that we need to understand why it was so. And the Shalom explains. We need to appreciate that the Madreig of Adam HaRishon, before his chait, this was the first chait in the history of the world. Before that, his entire level of existence was categorically different, fundamentally more elevated. We will find later on that Moshe Rabbeinu somehow was able to attain a throwback to that level when he finally came back from the 40 days on Har Sinai. His face was beaming. What happened? That means that he had absorbed Torah to a degree that his physical appearance radiated with the light of spirituality that he attained from the Torah. As the pasuk says, "V'hu lo yada ki koran or panav." His face was beaming. Karnei or. Karen is a horn. It's also a beam of light. Rembrandt was not sensitive to that dual meaning, and hence the famous painting and everything that came after that. But the original koronim of Moshe Rabbeinu are beams of light. This is the way that Adam HaRishon was before the chet, before he fell. So much so that there's a famous Gemara in Maseches Sota, which says that when HaKadosh Baruch Hu made for Adam and Chava kosnos or, with an ayin. Kosnos or means clothes for their skin. And Rabbi Meir, in the side of his Sefer Torah, wrote the word or with an aleph, kosnos or. And the Mefarshim explained that what he meant to indicate was, based on the statements of the Arizal, that before the chet, even the physical makeup of man was different, to the extent that you could describe him being clothed in light. Later on, as he becomes much more physical, he needs to be clothed in more what we call clothing. But and kosnos or with an aleph fell to kosnos or with an ayin. And that was that. And then he brought a korban. And What is the meaning of bringing a korban? Of course, there's much to say about that, but just in terms of the most basic idea, one of the basic ideas, a person brings a korban in a sense to represent them. What happens to the korban should really be happening to them. But the Shalom says one needs to understand the korban can't represent you unless it has an equivalence with you. Otherwise, the two have nothing to do with each other. A person brings an animal as a korban because part of bringing the korban is an acceptance, an awareness of the fact that a person has now, as a result of their sin, that much more in common with the animal they're bringing as a korban. When a person says, here is my korban, it's an ox, part of what they're saying is, me and this ox have more in common than we should do. It represents me. However, if that's true, then there's a critical caveat. Because there's a great danger. As important as it is for a person to realize that they have a problem, if they do, they cannot be allowed to over-realize it. And by that we mean they cannot be allowed to be confirmed in this new definition to the extent that it is irreversible. There are two people who will never solve their problems. The first is someone who refuses to realize they have a problem, and the second is someone who refuses to believe that anything can be done about it. They are on either side of help. And therefore, as important as it is for Adam Marishan to realize that Havdil, he has become like an ox, there is no way that he could bring an ox just like that. Because then the moral of the story is, so what do you want from me? I'm an ox. And that's why the Gemara says the ox that he brought, he had to bring an ox, but a certain type of ox. Keren achas b'mitzcha. It's got to have at least one horn facing up. That keren represents somehow a residue or a reminiscence, a nostalgia, and a longing to get back to the way that he used to be when other types of beams were coming out of his face. So the keren on the head of the ox represents, on the one hand, the ox says, this is what I've become, and the horn says, but I can do better, and I can get back to the way that I was. Greece, as they met the Jewish people, disputed this very point. We find that the Hellenistic overtones of life in Greek culture as it visited Israel essentially is saying that everything that is here and now, everything that is natural, that's what you should be aspiring to. That's where you should, your greatest efforts and your greatest talents should be developing the temporal. And thus there is such an emphasis on beauty and there's such an emphasis on nature. Those are things that are here. And in a sense, everyone has higher aspirations. The question is, where should they be channeled? To something higher than what we see around us? But along comes Yavon and says, well, there isn't really anything higher than what we see around us. So channel it into that. More beautiful statues and more beautiful theaters and stronger and faster. And the Baalei HaRemez say that the word yafeh, which of course says it all, beautiful, is actually a contraction of yud and po. And yud represents all of a person's aspirations. It is the letter of higher aspiration. It floats above the surface. It is the only letter. It doesn't rest on the ground. And it's always about the future. Yud is always az yashir, what will be. And yud po means everything that you're hoping for is right here. And therefore it should be invested accordingly. It turns out, one could say, that the point, and it was a fight to the hilt, the point of dispute between Yavon and the Jewish people was ultimately over the horn of an ox. Because the question is, what is man? Is man an ox with a horn or without a horn? And the Jewish people say, with. There's always got to be that keren. That is to say, everything that we're doing, everything we're developing, is always striving for something beyond what we have. And we have a Beis HaMikdash, but the end desired result is not the beauty of the Beis HaMikdash per se, but it's where it can take us. It's as a platform for something higher. When Greece says there is nothing higher, essentially the vision of the Torah is belittling the approach of Greece in a way that no barbarian ever could. Because the barbarian knows nothing. So you can introduce him to beauty. The Torah had it. And said it has its place, but it's not the be-all and end-all. And this now became the point of contention. Says Yovan to the Jewish people, we could be best of friends, or worst of enemies. We have so much in common, but one thing divides us, the horn of the ox. If you accept to invest everything in the ox itself, the way we do, then we'll get on famously. And if not, there will be repercussions. And hence the expression, what that horn represents is the Jewish people's looking at everything that Greece has to offer and say there may be room for it, but not as the ultimate goal in life, but only as a means to achieve that goal. This was a very difficult confrontation, because if a person did not have a depth of perspective, it would be possible to be of the understanding that there is no confrontation. Because because Greece and Torah, on a surface level, have so much in common. This is what sets aside Golos Yovan from all of the other Golios. Every other Golos, there was no way that one could avoid an awareness that one was in Golos. When you're carted off in chains to Bavel, you know you're in Golos. When Haman wants to destroy you, you know you're in Golos. And when Rome takes you away again, you know you're in Golos. But when Greece comes to visit you, to share ideas, if you're not alert, the Golos could happen and you never even realize. You're under control of ideas, not of chains. But ideas are stronger than chains, as we know. Ideas can bring down buildings, as we have seen, and do more. Every Golos is represented by darkness. So to take one of the four and say that was dark can only mean one thing. It was darker than dark. If every Golos is dark, then this Golos, to call it dark out of more than the others, means that it was darker than they were. But how can one get darker than dark? At this point, I'm always reminded of a statistic that I was told by my Rosh Hashiva, actually, which is reported by the Traffic Bureau, that there's a time of day when more accidents occur than any other time, and that is dusk. Not day and not night. Because at day you can see, and at night you know that it's dark, so you turn your lights on. Dusk has the worst of both worlds. It's dark enough not to be able to see, but light enough for you not to realize that you can't see, and disaster strikes. So from a certain point of view, dusk is darker than night because people actually fumble around more in that time than they do when it's pitch dark because they don't realize that it's dark. And therefore, the insidious quality of Golos Yovan, the reason why it's darker than dark, is because it allowed the Jewish people to be of the self-image that there was actually nothing dark going on, and then there was no protection against stumbling. From a certain point of view, the greatest chiddush of that time was Matisyo and his sons, who stood up and said something that no one else understood. They said, it's dark in here, whereas everybody else thought it's never been brighter. And they went to war over it, and the rest is the story of Hanukkah. And this explains to us why there's so much emphasis on Hanukkah, on beauty, actually. Hidur mitzvah is all over the mitzvah in terms of the number and the materials and the menorah. It's everywhere. And the reason why is this is our statement against Yovan. Not to reject Hidur, not to reject beauty, but to show what its place is, that it doesn't become the end game, the be-all and end-all and the subtotal of our endeavors, but rather it is a platform to use as a mitzvah for Avodas Hashem. We say that the miracles of Chanukah are Bayamim Mahem Bazman Hazeh. Bayamim Mahem means the event of Chanukah took place in those days. Bazman Hazeh means the issues at stake continue until our time. And the yearly reminder of Chanukah, with its 8 days to ponder and to reflect on these issues, are days that we need to use wisely. Because the question of our relationship with things of this world and our investment of things of this world is as current, even if there are not Greeks at the doorstep, but they've made their mark and their message is here, even as they've disappeared. And it's something that needs to be confronted on an ongoing basis. And bayamim bahim bazmanazeh, we use the time of Hanukkah to reinforce our resolve and our awareness, our alertness to the issue, and our commitment that as much as we are involved in this world and invested in this world and occupied in this world, it should always take its place as kelim for something higher. And emetz Hashem, the horn and the forehead of the ox should be realized, and we should take us to those all of those higher things that we are aspiring to. Wish you all a happy Hanukkah. I mentioned there will be no shir next week. We'll meet again emetz Hashem 2 weeks time. 2 weeks.